Okay. Today is April 9th, 2019, and this is Karen Brewster, and I'm here in Anchorage, Alaska with Grant Crosby at the National Park Service Regional Office. This is for the Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park Oral History Project. Grant, thank you for finding time this afternoon.
Sure, it's a pleasure.
Just to get us started, can you give me a little bit of background about yourself?
Sure. I'm Grant Crosby and grew up in Minneapolis. Went to college at Lewis and Clark College in Portland, Oregon, where I studied history and got a Bachelor of Arts in history. And during that time, I think the genesis for my historic preservation interest started when I was on an overseas program in India for 6 months and then came back to the States, and there was an opportunity near my home to buy a historic barn from the state of Minnesota. And the price tag was right. It was for $5, but the stipulation was I had to take it down.
Oh, no.
So I did. I proceeded to do it, taking it down piece by piece, labeling him, and from there saved all the wood. And I laugh about it now. The way that I recorded the building was basically on craft paper, which I have no idea where it is or if it even is legible. And saved all the building parts and still have it to this day at my parents' place in Minneapolis. But during the process, I started studying historic preservation and barns specifically, and then saving old buildings. And when I got back to college for my final year, I talked to a professor, a history professor, and he said, you know, why don't you do an internship? And he suggested the Historic Preservation League of Oregon. So I called them up, and it turns out that they had an opportunity for me to help organize their technical library, which is kind of a sleeper of a job, but it got me into the door, so to speak. And the executive director there was a lady named Lisa Burcham, I think, who was recently graduated from the University of Oregon School of Architecture's Historic Preservation Program. So one of the days that I was supposed to go in there, she said, why don't you just take the afternoon and head down to Eugene? I was in Portland. I said, go down to Eugene and meet the folks down there at the University of Oregon. So I did that. I met the head of the program, Don Peating, and a few others, and toured some buildings. And they mentioned that there was this historic preservation field school happening that summer, the first that of many that still go on. This would have been 1995. And so it was at the Peter French Round Barn in Burns, Oregon. Yeah. And so after graduating from college, later that summer, I headed out to Burns, Oregon, and participated in the University of Oregon's first ever field school. That fall after that program, I applied for the Historic Preservation Program, a master's program, 2 years, and was working just doing carpentry and other things back in Minneapolis at the time for that intervening year. And the next summer, which would have been 1996, I guess, the next field school was at Port Orford, Oregon. And so I attended that field school. It then became a requirement that every incoming student, I think, had to attend the field school. So I attended that one, then that year I started the Historic Preservation Program and thought that I'd do 2 years and be done and go back out and be a contractor of some sort doing preservation work. But soon after getting into that program, I started hanging around the architecture school, meeting architecture students, and before I knew it, I was applying for the architecture program as well. And they had a concurrent degree thing, so if you did both degrees at the same time, you're able to minimize the number of credits in one of the programs. So I took the architecture program as my lead program and then did just a slight fewer credits in the preservation program. Long story short, I ended up getting a master's in architecture degree first, which was in 2000, and effectively sandwiched that with a historic preservation degree. So the first year in school was historic preservation and 3.5 years of architecture, and then one more final year of historic preservation where I wrote my thesis. But one of the way that I got to Alaska, or even into the Park Service, is one of the stipulations that was required of students in historic preservation was to do an internship with either an agency or a private firm. And all these people were coming back from Alaska saying, you got to go up there and do this trip or this internship. It's amazing. It's the most amazing place. So I kept it in my mind as I had to finish the architecture degree. And then by the time I was wrapping that up, I applied for a HAIR, Historic American Engineering Record, internship up here for the year of summer of 2000. And it was to go out and do the documentation on the Kennecott Mill building, all the equipment inside the building.
Wow.
So another student and I were hired for that position. We drove the Alcan in June of 2000. And this will tie back eventually to Skagway, which is funny. Because we took, there's the Cassiar and then there's the regular one. And we deviated, and I think it was either on the way up or the way back, I can't remember which. We did go down from Whitehorse down to Skagway. Mm-hmm. And I remember driving through that town like, holy cow, this is amazing, this little place with all these historic buildings. And to come to work there later is kind of amusing for me because everything seemed to be an accident just getting here. So anyway, the internship was amazing. We went out here, went out to Kennecott and spent a lot of time out there and documented all this information. And I knew that I had to go back and finish my thesis in Oregon. And I was living on a historic farm in Oregon, a place called Doris Ranch, caretaking this 1898 building.
Wow.
And figured, okay, well, I'm comfortable there. I'll just see what happens next. And when I was leaving, my predecessor in this position, Steve Peterson, had said, we've got a position opening up. You should apply for it. And I thought nothing of it. I was like, well, that's polite. Thank you. I appreciate the interest. Sounds like an interesting idea. We'll see what happens. And so I went back to Eugene and just immersed myself in my thesis. And he called again and said, that application is about to close. Have you got your application? Or that opportunity is going to close. Have you got your application? And I said, no, but I'll get around to it. I put something together. I applied, put my full effort into it. And then he called and said, let's set up a time for an interview. And I was just moving awfully fast, you know. And I was still wrapping up my thesis. This would have been in the spring of 2001. And I had to present my thesis that May, I think, and graduate. And I remember it was very, I got to know Steve Peterson very well. And this was very telling of not only his personality, but also the federal hiring process, because he called me up to set up an interview time, and he said, well, how about now? You know, and so in my mind, I was thinking, well, geez, I need to, you know, refresh my memory on certain standards or whatever. And I said, yes, I guess let's do it now. And so he called back a few days later and offered the job. And at that point, I was like, geez, this is really moving fast. And I said yes. And I said yes because I figured, what the heck, I'll go up there for 2 years, maybe 5 years on the outside. And that was in 2001, and here we are in 2019.
Yeah, so, still here.
Still here.
And your current position is you're the regional historical architect?
That's correct, yeah.
And what does that entail? What do you do?
That oversees the historic architecture program and the cultural landscape program. And things related to historic structures and landscapes is basically the intent there. So,
besides Klondike and Wrangell St. Elias with Kennecott, what other Alaska parks have historical structures?
Well, pretty much most of them. The stuff up north I haven't been into too much, like Bella and places. I've been there a few times. Mm-hmm. But Glacier Bay has the Glacier Bay Lodge and has some structures out in the park. Sitka's got the Russian Bishop's House.
Okay.
Among others, Denali's got some Mission 66 stuff more recently, but they've got the historic road cabins and mining. Fairbanks or Yukon Charlie, they have the gold
cabins,
dredge and cabins. So, and Katmai has historic structures as
they
well.
Do?
So,
okay.
So we cover quite a bit of ground, yeah.
And so does that include doing preservation work on all of those structures?
It does, and we get a phone call. So if there's a project on, say, a cabin, it may be re-roofing it or putting new sill logs under it, or they've got to do some maintenance work on it. So we've got to review that project with them to ensure that it meets the standards, the historic preservation standards. Yeah.
And how are those building restorations or repairs, whatever, funded?
Mostly by the funding that comes through from the repair rehab funding source or the cyclic maintenance. That's where those typically come from. They're coming down from Washington's allocation for each of the regions has a certain amount of funding for those parks or for those regions, and then they divvy it up through the parks.
And so the parks themselves don't have their own pot of money?
Sometimes they do. No, it's a regional service-wide program where they compete for it, but they have to write a PMIS project, a project management information system project, and compete it against other regional projects. And then the maintenance advisory group, MAG, gets together every year and they convene a meeting and they compete these projects against each other. and each park puts forward projects to be funded for the out year, whatever it is. Same with the Cultural Resources Group. And so the money is, by and large, those two fund sources. There used to be some funding for specifically historic structures, but that's since been absorbed into the Cultural Resource Program. So, you know, any project would have a description written, and it would be anything as small as replace a window on a cabin or a door to let's fully rehabilitate a building. And so it could go anywhere from $15,000 to $250,000.
Right.
So, yeah.
And so how did you get involved with doing work in Skagway?
Yeah, this comes back to that amusing being at the right place at the right time with Steve Peterson. Steve, who I think started in about 89 or 90 with the National Park Service in this position, and he'd been spending a lot of time working in Klondike, and I think he had other projects going, and I started in 2001. In fact, my first day of work was September 10th, 2001. So the next day the office was closed, obviously, and really kind of a telling sign of where I was in my life. I can always remember it. But Steve had lined up a few projects that we were going to do that fall, and he said, okay, next up is to go down to Klondike, and I do these building inspections every year. I go walk through them, and I write up a report at the end of the thing. And my job at that time was to work for the National Register Program, doing more technical assistance outreach to the owners of historic buildings that were not in the National Park Service. So the Virginia Long, like you mentioned. And but the problem was there was so much work at that time that I was doing a lot of park work and external work, so I was kind of double dipping in that sense. But the program I was hired for was really that technical assistance. So we went down there to do these maintenance inspections, spent a week crawling around buildings and writing up these reports. And by the end of the week, he more or less said, okay, well, this is your park. You know, you take on this program and go forward and do good things. And, I mean, he still got involved and he still helped out. But I think by that time he had seen other projects that he was working on and knew that his capacity had now just increased. So he handed that off. And so I did those annual inspection reports, still do them, not every year. We do them intermittently. And then got to know a lot of people in the community to help out with outreach projects as well. And got to know the buildings in Klondike as well, quite well.
So tell me more about this technical assistance program and how that works. So it's a park service program and you're helping people in the communities?
Yeah, so the going all the way back to the Antiquities Act, the National Park Service has been handed this responsibility of adhering and managing the standards, the Secretary of the Interior standards for the treatment of historic properties. And through others enabling legislation, they have indicated that the Park Service is not only responsible for managing historic structures in the parks, but also the outreach, the education to encourage others to do that and to manage programs, one of which is the National Register Program. And with included in that was this ability to go beyond the borders of the parks and say, hey, we're here to provide you assistance, technical assistance as you need it. And I suppose you could interpret it different ways. I think we took it as an opportunity to really get involved with people and help them seek out either the technical nature of what they need to do to their building, but we're also writing grants and letters of support, whatever we can do to help move that project forward. And so we did quite a few. When I say we, it was a team effort. All sorts of people were involved, but I think one of the more salient ones, and one of the most successful ones, was the Portland building, clearly.
In Virginia Skagway. Long's
Virginia
building.
Virginia Long and Howard Smith, yeah.
Right.
And I were talking before we started the recording, but I just had lunch with somebody from Cordova, a similar project where we were working on the Pioneer Igloo. And my comment was, because the person I had lunch with is now one of these people that goes out and just says, we have to preserve everything we have to do. I said, Jim, this is one of the situations where we invested a little bit of time in you, and now here you are running around the state telling everybody they've got to preserve it to these standards. And that's exactly our hope, is that we can provide a representative example of what a successful project is. And that's what happened with the Portland House, certainly is. And Virginia and Howard, they were somewhat hesitant, I think, at first, but then they recognized the opportunity and the value that they had with that. And we applied for and received, I think, three grants with them. They applied for them, They probably got $150,000 through grant funding to help with their project.
Wow.
Plus or minus.
What kind of grants? I mean, are they Park Service grants? Or
are there
specific grants out there for historic building preservation?
That's correct, yes. So one of the key components of being listed or eligible for listing on the National Register or a National Historic Landmark is there are grant funds out there for those types of buildings specifically. And so in the case of, I'd have to look back, but I think it might have either been a State Historic Preservation Fund grant. So ultimately it would be federal money back at the beginning, but then it would be handed to the State Historic Preservation Office, the SHPO, to manage. And then they would put out a request for applications, and we would help write those applications. And anybody who asked, we started writing more and more of those, knowing that they'd had a finite amount of money and a lot of interested projects. So around the state here, we probably wrote half a dozen or probably a dozen.
Well, I mean, that's a great help for a building owner because they don't necessarily have experience in grant writing.
Right.
Or they don't have the technical terminology.
Right. Exactly.
That you would have.
Yep. So we would do just that, is use the right terminology that relate to the standards, speak to the issues associated with the building, and we'd help try and line up the appropriate professionals because we're not a one-stop shop for architecture and engineering, so we
right.
would do what we could. If it's a small enough project, we can take that on and do some of the drawings. We never stamp our drawings for licensing or anything of that nature, but we provide those recommendations and or work closely with them to write the scope of work to hire an engineer or a preservation architect or somebody else.
And then also, what about hiring the carpenters and people to do the actual work?
We do that sometimes, but a lot of times in small communities like Skagway, they would know who they'd want to use. And at some point, you have to let go a little bit because either they invite us to help educate the contractor or not. So the concept is there on paper, and hopefully they follow it. Sometimes we've seen it happen, and sometimes they go a different direction. And so we try and work with them as well as possible. But they have a contractual agreement between them, so we don't want
right.
to get in the way of that.
Because doing restoration carpentry is a very specific skill.
It is and it isn't. I mean, the concepts of carpentry are very much the same. It's really an appreciation for slowing down and the willingness to take the time to do it correctly. Where when you peel off, if you're just doing a what I like to call a garden variety project, where you just throw everything away, you're ripping things off, you don't care if they break,
right.
and you throw them in the dumpster. But with this, we're trying to preserve all of this intact fabric, so we want to do it very, very carefully. And you don't want to put in a nail hole, or you want to have all these mule tracks from hammers and everything else. So you want to do it in a process that really works well.
Well, and you want it to look as much like the original as
right.
possible. So I was thinking like a door or a window.
Yep.
You know, I don't have the technical terms, but all those things were made a particular way in the Victorian era
than
they are now, and people don't know necessarily how to do that.
The old expression about they don't make them like they used to, and we are constantly talking to people about tearing out the old windows and putting in a new vinyl triple pane or double pane. They say we just need to save energy. And the fact of the matter is there's so much value, not only from the historic aspect, but in the quality of material from these old ones, that you just can't get it anymore.
Right.
And it's really an effort to get people to understand that what you have is really quite nice. And yes, if it's deteriorated, we can fix that. But let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater and just replace everything. We're dealing with some projects in other communities right now where they want to do just that. They want to tear out the windows and get rid of them wholesale, and we're trying to encourage them to slow down and think about it.
Well, can you make new windows to look old, and that acceptable? Or that's
yes,
not?
Yes. Well, so that would be what we call replacement in kind. So you would want to match the same species of wood, the same profiles, the same size, as much as you can, and then if it's painted, paint it again. You've seen old glass where it has the dimples in it.
Mm-hmm.
Today, you can buy that. Sometimes it's a funny expression because it is overblown. You know, the glass has too many dimples.
Oh.
And we've seen that out at Kennicott, for example, where we ordered a bunch of glass and it came back with just tons of dimples, more than you'd see in a historic window. And so, yes, you can replace it. So if you have, for example, a project that we're working on in Juno, over time, they remove certain windows and doors, and those are no longer there.
Right.
If we want to restore it back to that period, what we'll do is use an existing window as a sample and then build new ones to match that, and they will go back in as new windows.
That's what I was wanting, too, in, like, photographs. Like, if a door had been replaced in the 50s, and that's the current door, that might not be what the original, but if there's a photo from 1898,
right,
then having a skilled carpenter who can now make one to look like the old one.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's a good transition into something, because Carl Gerke, who has such a wonderful knowledge of not only the history of Skagway, but the photo collection that they have in the park, and his ability to say, well, you know, I've seen a picture of that building, and what he likes to do is put together photographic essays. And we use those on all of our projects because it helps us understand what the history of the building is. And the preparation of reports like that are critical to successful restorations. And another tidbit about Skagway is at some point in the 1990s, they constructed a wonderful world-class wood shop so they could start producing doors and windows, because mm-hmm. they were in the business very much of preserving historic buildings when they started in the 80s. Late 70s, I think, not 79, I believe, is probably when some of the earlier ones were started. And having that shop there enabled them to have all the right equipment to produce on a larger scale all of these doors, windows, and the profiles that were associated with them. And there was some discussion, and we're trying to bring this back into today's world, of making that a facility that people can use if they have a big project. And that maybe Denali or Katmai has a project. Could they spend some time down in Klondike using that shop? There's housing there in the winter, and the shop is usually pretty available. So,
yeah.
Great opportunity.
Yeah, but like a community member such as Virginia and Howard, they don't have access to that.
They don't, unless they have. We've had communications with superintendents through the years to say, you know, what can we do? The liability is the big concern, because if they lose a finger or something like that, then, you know, who's to blame?
But I think Virginia said that Don Corwin may have helped do some of her doors or windows.
He did. Don Corwin was very active on that project, and he was one of the early and long-term practitioners or the preservationist on the Klondike Gold Rush buildings. And so he knows that shop forward and backwards.
Right.
And he has his own equipment now that he travels around with in a van, and he can unload it at a project. He's been all over the place, from Guam to Nome. And
So he did that sort of as a side, not as a Park Service.
He was no longer as a Park Service employee. He had his own company doing that. Yeah. And he restored it. You know, Don's one of those guys that can look at a historic photograph and piece together and some of the evidence of the building, and then piece together how this thing's going to unfold, and he can rebuild it.
So how does a historic architect collaborate with the people doing the work? What's that relationship?
Generally speaking, I mean, if we back up even further, you'd have a historian in the mix, too, and the historian would do research to figure out the history of the building, the changes over time. We lean on a document called a Historic Structure Report, an HSR, and that speaks to the building's history. It speaks to the changes over time. It speaks to the physical attributes of the building, a very detailed description, and then it makes recommendations for treatment on whatever the objective is of the park or the owner. And so in that process, we would create a plan of action, and sometimes it's just in narrative, other times it's with photographs or drawings, and then the craftsperson would use those to move forward. So in the case of the Portland building, knowing that we didn't have the capacity to take on any architectural drawings, Amanda Welsh was hired. She's an architect out of Ketchikan, and she came up and did a couple site visits and made 5 or 6 sheets of drawings that were used for the restoration of the building. So,
okay.
Yeah.
And so, but you helped connect Virginia with Amanda. So,
right.
Yeah.
And then we would be a sounding board for Amanda or for Virginia, and we'd help use that information to prepare grants. And so we were sort of a middle person on the job and helping.
Yeah, I recall Virginia mentioning your name and that you had come and helped quite a bit. And So wondering what your role had been. And so you physically spent time down there.
Absolutely, absolutely. We'd spend time down there going through the buildings and inspecting things and making suggestions, and sometimes they'd carry them out, sometimes they wouldn't. You know, as an aside, and I think I can say this openly on this project, is Howard Smith, Virginia's partner, was never really that enthused about the project. And they're both smokers, and I always used to joke with Howard that he'd just take one of his finished cigarettes and throw it into the building and watch it go up in flames. And I think that would have saved him a lot of angst. But again, Howard was as much as Virginia, one of those people who recognized the beauty of what they've done. And to this day, he still smiles from ear to ear when he sees the success of what he accomplished. And so that by far is really what this program is about, is to get these people, I say, drinking the Kool-Aid of preservation, getting them excited about it, and then encouraging other people to do it as well. Virginia went so far as to join the Historic District Commission after she was successfully completing that project. And she said, you know, if I have to do it, everybody else is going to follow in suit because it makes a lot of sense and let's do it right. And there is, when you get into the details of a well-accomplished project and one that's sort of less so, you can see the difference in just the quality. So they restored boards, you know, 25. Yeah. I mean, you've seen it. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's what they did.
Yep.
They did it one board at a time, pretty much. So do you have any specific examples of other places in Skagway that have now started as a result of the Portland House?
I would think that some of the work on the First Presbyterian Church, those folks got very engaged and did some work to further the efforts there. I think they had to modify the door to get in, the primary door. But we met with them a few times. We've participated, I'm just trying to think, on an external basis. More projects that come to mind here as we're going through. Mm-hmm. We've consulted on a lot, but some have not chosen to follow that line of action. So.
And do you know why they've chosen not to?
I think time is money, you know, down there in particular. And the return on investment, if you're going to spend all that time and energy, they've got to have it up and running for action pretty quickly. Another one that comes to mind is the Old City Hall and Moe's Bar, mm-hmm. two buildings that were owned by the Moe family, and we helped consult with them on both of them. They ended up selling both. The Moe's Bar on Broadway was sold to a private company who now runs a tourist outfit out of there. And much to my dismay, because it was a beautiful little building and it had a lot of integrity and significance, but they chose to take out the floor between the first and second, and so it's just one volume now on the mm-hmm. inside. And they modified the entry and everything else. And then the Old City Hall, the Moe family ended up selling that to the city of Skagway. And so we've been consulting with the city on the preservation plan for that. And that building is extremely unique because we have photographs of it when there were still trees growing in the street and the building was under construction.
Cool.
So Carl's able to pull these photos out and show them to us so we can see the sequence of the construction. And then when it was acquired by the city, it had multiple additions off the back end of this building. And you could see the whole thing was just right there in the evidence of the building. And our recommendation was, if you want to restore it back to that Old City Hall, we should remove these additions. And I think they saw that as an opportunity to, you know, reduce the amount of work they'd have if they can take off half that. And so they did. They actually followed through with that recommendation. And we have an interesting set of drawings that illustrate that process. And so that's in the that building is right now still an active project, one that we hope to have more assistance with as it moves forward.
And where is the City Hall?
Right across the street from the Portland building. So that's the little white building, one and a half story.
No, it's not the YMCA one.
That's
a Park Service project.
That's to the west. Yeah, that's the Park Service project, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I had the question of, you know, how do you decide what date to restore something to?
That's a very good question. And a lot of times in that document, the HSR or a National Register nomination, they put parameters on as they do the research. What's the period of significance? And so if the period of significance is 1898 to 1915, somewhere in that window is what you're desiring to get back to as a period of time. And so you could make the argument if one or two of those additions happened in 1910, and there was enough significance associated with it, you could retain that. But in the case of this building, we thought that the real period of significance was back there at the beginning as a city hall, as a land office, and so that's why we mm-hmm. removed the additions.
And the period of significance, that's based on the historical research.
Correct.
And what happened in that building at that time.
Right, right. And it could be a series of events. It could be somebody's, you think of a president's house, for example, or some event or some feature, or architecturally, did it have a certain period that was notable for that, what it looked like?
Mm-hmm.
So that, there's a lot of factors that play into it, and then from there you decide what the period of significance is. And then you have to look at the building and study it to figure out, have there been changes that need to be either added or removed to get it back into that period. So.
And what about if there are photographs? What if the period of significance is decided, but there aren't any photographs for that, but you have photographs for another period? Would you then do it based on the photos?
You could, and these are all decisions that you make as the project's moving forward. Sometimes if you don't have photographs, you might have in situ evidence that you can use to base your findings on. If you've got a period of time that you've got clear photographic evidence of, that makes a strong argument for trying to do that. But if it's not, that period's not significant enough in the building's history, then you might go backwards and try and figure out what you can with what you have.
Like the Portland House photo with the asbestos covering did not make that what you want to keep.
It didn't, but a lot of times, in fact, I just used this line 2 days ago, was one of the best friends of historic preservation is when people don't have the money to tear off what's there already, they just put it on top. And with the Portland House, and to a certain extent the Old City Hall, we knew one day, we just said, you know what, you should pull up some of that asphalt, that whatever it was on the outside. And sure enough, you could see the original siding. And so we were looking at historic photographs, and there was a detailed pattern up there on the top of the building. And we said, you know, why don't we get a ladder and get up there and just let's pull off one of these things and let's target some of these places. So we did a window header first. Mm-hmm. And then we went up there, and sure enough, everything was still intact, just there hidden.
Yeah.
You know? So all the clues are there.
Right.
Yeah. So you just need to find it.
Right. So what's been your involvement with some of the Park Service buildings in Skagway?
So the Park Service buildings, again, going back to the work with Steve Peterson, was doing the annual inspections. So I climbed through the crawl spaces, the attics, and everywhere in between to record their condition. And I think this was a really important program because everybody in the park is seeing those buildings every day, day to day. So they don't necessarily see the problems that may be there. So when we come in once or twice a year to look at these buildings, we're seeing them with this eye that's intent on finding the problems. And so that was a really good program. So we did a lot of work through all of the Park Service, lease back or not. And then if there were projects, for example, another very early project in my career was modifying the bathrooms in the visitor center of the depot. And there's always a joke about architects and bathrooms, because when you start off in a new career in an architecture firm, the first thing you're doing is designing bathrooms. Yeah, so this fit right in there. So it was about 2002 that I was working on those bathrooms. And it was a challenge because they didn't meet accessibility in the park at that time. The superintendent had received a letter that said, from somebody who said, hey, these things don't meet accessibility, and this is a federal building, so on and so forth. So we went about to try and come up with a change. And it was a challenging project. We turned a janitor's closet into an accessible bathroom was the end result. But a lot of changes and a lot of meetings and a lot of people were saying, well, that's not going to work. So examples of smaller scale projects where we go in and help on that degree. But then Teresa Tebow, the then chief of resources, started communicating with Miss Brown, I've forgotten her name.
Phyllis
Brown, there you go.
Rapuzzi.
The Rapuzzi Collection, yeah. This was about, could have been 2006, or you probably have the dates.
I don't know
more
the date.
Clearly.
I don't know the dates.
But she ended up working closely with the Rasmussen Foundation to figure out how to make this happen. And with the acquisition of those buildings, which happened, I think it was official in 2008, with that came a whole bunch of work that we got involved with. So similar to what I came up to Alaska for in the first place, the Historic American Engineering Record, we were preparing Historic American Building Survey drawings, HABS drawings, of the buildings that were acquired during that purchase.
So those were Rapuzzi buildings?
The former Rapuzzi buildings? So Soapy Smith's Parlor, the World War II Commissary, the Rapuzzi House, and then the YMCA and the Meyer Building. And so those buildings needed all of this work done, HSRs and HABS documentation, HABS photography. So I got involved leading those projects and helping bring those to fruition. And from there, we had future projects. I think it was probably 2011 that we started working on Soapy's Smith's Parlor. And in that case, we worked with a design firm here in town, Rim Architects, to come up with the plan to restore that for a museum. And along the way, we were working on other ones. So the YMCA and the Meyer had some work done by other consultants as well. But to this day, I'm still working on the drawings for some of those. We're trying to stay one step ahead of them, like the crews in there.
Because they're currently working on that YMCA Myers building, right?
That's correct, yeah.
But you have to keep writing plans for them? They don't have an architectural plan to work off of?
They don't. I hate to say that on tape here, but no. Ideally, that would be completed in advance. We're just short-staffed, and the level of detail that we're going into on this is such that it'd be hard to get anything for a reasonable cost by a regular architecture firm. So we have, I'd say, 50 sheets of drawings for that building, those two buildings. And that's part of the problem is there's two buildings
right
there. And we're trying to have enough detail to keep the maintenance crew on track and ahead, thinking ahead
right
to the next thing, but also trying to just get a complete set done.
Yeah, so that's what I was saying. Yeah. Like, how can they do that being... You need to keep giving them something to work on,
right,
and how you keep everybody one step ahead.
Yeah, in some cases, if I'm on site, we're talking right there in front of the building and going through this process of saying, well, if this, then that. Or they'll say, by next week, I need to figure out this detail, and so that we have to drop things and make that happen. So,
yeah.
It's not the preferred way, but it does work. Yeah.
It does work.
Yeah.
You mentioned accessibility, and that mm-hmm made me think about... when you're restoring buildings and now you have to meet new code, accessibility or earthquake or whatever it might be. You have to put an elevator in a building that clearly never had an elevator,
right,
like the Pantheon.
Right. Yep.
So how do you reconcile those with being true to the original period you're trying to restore to?
Good question. I was just talking again about that this past week with some people. Fortunately, the building codes recognize the significance of historic buildings, and they recognize that process, that litmus test, if you will, of a National Register nomination or being eligible for that. And they indicate in the code that if the building is historic, deemed historic or eligible, that there are some allowances that you can do. Accessibility is one of them, and it's not to say that the whole building has to be made accessible, but certain features need to be made accessible. So what you'll often find is an accessible entrance, for example, into a building. It may not be on that massive character-defining feature, very important front facade, where there's steps going up into it, but you might make an opportunity on the side or in the back. And then people can get into the building. There's allowances, for example, if the doors aren't wide enough, and if it's off by 2 inches, they'll have an allowance and say, okay, well, it's such a massive undertaking, or we're going to lose too much of that integrity if we adjust it. So they give you some allowances. But as federal buildings, we want to make them accessible.
Right.
And so we do what we can, and sometimes you just have to justify it and say, well, here's the situation. We're going to make it as compatible as we can and do the best we can. So
you have to. Would you have to ever put in a new door out the back side of a building?
Yes, that's happened. I mean, for example, on the YMCA building, the use of the building is going to be an assembly space, and so by current code you have to have a certain number of exits for this many people. So we're actually putting a hole in the wall with a new door in the back so that there's another exit into the building.
And does that door meet historic standards, or
it'll be manufactured in a compatible style? It's not like going to Home Depot and buying a new one. It's going to be built in that shop that we mentioned earlier.
Right.
Yeah. Following a style that we determined would be appropriate for that period.
Because, like I was thinking, the Railroad Depot Visitor Center, that doesn't have an elevator, does it?
It doesn't, but there's a project in the queue right now that they've been trying to put one in, and it's a tough one because we'd have to take up some office space on both the first and second floor to make it happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so how did they get away with not having to do that when they restored the building?
At that time, that was done in the 1980s, and then the ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act, would have been 1990. So it preceded that. Doesn't make it right.
No, but does that make it sort of grandfathered in?
To a certain extent. But I think the federal government recognizes the value of people being able to get into the buildings. And so if there's a second way to do it, where if you can come up with an alternative means to either communicate with people. So in this case, the superintendent's office is up on the second floor, and even if you got into the second story of the visitor centers, you'd still have two steps to get up into. So, and we always think about it as people in wheelchairs. It's not right. The case. You know, it could be any other disability. But I think there's alternatives by saying, okay, well, maybe the superintendent needs a space down on the first floor where they could meet with somebody if need be. It's just, I had another example.
That's a good example.
Well, here's a great example in Sitka, where the Russian Bishop's House is the second oldest building in the state, built 1842. And the ground floor is open to visitors. The second floor is open for guided tours, but there is no elevator. Mm-mm. And they program space for it, but they never put it in. So what they have is a video down on the first floor. So they have a great video showing all of what you can see on the second floor, narrated. So that's an accessible option for people to see. So
yeah, I don't even think how the Russian Bishop's House structurally could stand the weight of an elevator.
Well, the two, I always forget the name of them, but the two side wings were reconstructed, and okay. In that process they could have put in an elevator. Okay. So there's a closet that's big enough that could fit an elevator. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I know that some buildings have sort of these stair elevators.
Yes, yeah. The one that goes up like a handrail?
No, there's those kind, but they're just small, mm-hmm. kind of right next to the stairway.
Yep. That's called a limited use, limited access. And that's for the Pantheon, for example. That's
mm-hmm. Is that what they have?
That's what that is, yeah.
Yeah. So. Well, I was also thinking about, you mentioned Soapy Smith's, and that's a good example of a building that's been moved.
Yeah, numerous times.
Yes, numerous times. Yeah. And how does that work? How do you move a historic building without it falling down?
You know, that's a good question. And again, Carl Gerke has stories and photos. In fact, outside of my cubicle, I have a map that he prepared showing dots and then all the lines between them saying which building were moved where. And in Skagway, they'd move them all the time.
Yeah, I mean, they moved them, you know, even back in the Gold Rush time, in the 1910s, they moved them.
They would.
And you know, nowadays, okay, you have cribbing and you have heavy equipment, but how did they do it back then?
They would figure out how to get it up on a set of wheels and or rolling logs and just with horses just pull it.
And is that typical for a place that they move buildings so much, or is that something unique about Skagway?
I think it's unique to that era more. I think it's unique to Skagway, number one, but I think it's also unique to people put in the effort of building something. Resources might be scarce, and why tear it down if you can just put it over there and repurpose it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the Goldberg Cigar Store has been moved, I think, 7 times.
Wow. And that doesn't affect its historic...
It does. Integrity?
Yeah.
Yeah, setting and location are key components of the building's integrity. It doesn't mean that it's going to not make it eligible, but it is a significant factor in the building's history. So moving them is critical. But in Skagway, the argument is that that was part of the history. They moved buildings enough.
Right.
So it's part of the history.
Yeah. So Soapy Smith's is now in its original location?
No, Soapy's is, I want to say it's been moved 4 times since there. I think it was originally located down on 5th.
Oh, okay.
5th or 6th.
Mm-hmm. Now it's what, on 2nd?
Yeah, it was on the north side of 5th, I believe. 5th or 4th. But yeah, that was moved. And an interesting thing for the listeners on this is that a lot of the walls were in that building. It was 3 segments of building pushed together, in large part by George Rapuzzi. And we believe that one of those is the original Soapy Smith den, or whatever you want to call it. And the thought was that maybe when it got moved, the front became the back. They just didn't bother turning it around, you know. And when we were crawling around that building, we saw all sorts of evidence of fires in the attic, different locations of stovepipes, different locations of doors, all sorts of things. And when it came time to do the project, the structural engineer and the idea of making it appropriate for a museum put all these curatorial standards on it, and for heating and ventilation, it would have leaked like a sieve. So we put the walls inside the existing walls. So the new walls went inside, and we could insulate them to what we needed. So the actual original walls are still in that cavity.
But so the original wall, when you look on it from the outside, are you looking at original walls?
No, that, I mean, I don't think very much of that's the original exterior. I think it's been replaced a lot over the years. But inside of that, once you get inside that skin, you're going to see some boards from 1898 for sure.
So I haven't been in it. Is there like some plexiglass opening so you visitor can see that original?
I'm trying to think if we did that or not. I don't think we did.
Because I know they do that sometimes.
They do, yeah. We've done that in the church in Kenai. A window into the wall.
Yeah.
I don't think we did that in Sobeys.
Well, you mentioned that you can tell there's fires or where there'd been a stovepipe. That stuff's all there in an old building?
Especially in Skagway. I've been up in attics. I bet you half a dozen where you get up and you see next to a stovepipe or in an old location of a stovepipe, just charred roof boards.
But how do you know there was a stovepipe? Does it leave a mark on the wall?
There'd be a hole that's covered. Okay. Yeah, so a round hole is typically covered.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A lot of near misses.
Yeah. I mean, what other things do you find that old? What other stories are old buildings telling you when you're crawling around in there?
The crew in the YMCA building had a wonderful find in about 2010 or 11, and they were working on the floor of the building, and they found an old bowler hat, squished flat underneath the floor, is in the sawdust. Then they were working on the wall, on the north wall, almost immediate as you walk into the Meyer building adjoining it. And as they're pulling off boards, they found a pistol and a roll of string.
Yeah.
And we never could figure out what the story was, but the collection has that pistol now. And it was a very small one meant to be discreetly carried. And it was that high enough, it was probably 10 feet off the ground. And what's interesting about that is we have some newspaper articles, and this is where you're piecing together all these different facts of a building. We have a newspaper article that spoke about a bleacher in the building, or a loft of some sort that would enable people to sit up in the stands and look down on a basketball game. And my only thought is maybe that something was going to happen and that person figured they were going to get discovered or whatever and threw it in the wall somehow.
Yeah.
But is that a height above the floor to where you couldn't just do it from standing on the floor?
Wow.
And so then you start asking about questions like that and saying, what is the building telling us? The in situ evidence is often a really fun discovery, because when you read that in an article that says, you know, let's say the article's from 1900 and it said that the spectators were in their stands, we went back and looked at the building again, and you see certain holes that might have been anchor rods from the ceiling to help suspend that space. And then they spoke of windows on that wall. As we're looking through old photographs, we see one at a very obtuse angle that shows those windows that you're speaking of, and other components on the building that are no longer there, which explains why siding isn't consistent on a certain wall. So all these things start to come together. It's like a big mystery.
Yeah, it's like a big jigsaw puzzle.
Right, right.
And I can see so that the historian and the historical architect restorer all have to work very closely together.
Absolutely, and it's very interesting. Everybody sees it from a different perspective, and I think from the historical architect's perspective, is it's often like, where are we going to go? How are we going to make this happen? How is it going to work as a functioning building while retaining all of that character?
Right. So the historical research. Do you guys, as the architect, do that, or the historian does that?
Sometimes. It depends on the staffing level for the project. A lot of times, if you don't have a historian on staff, or if in these technical assistance projects, for example, it may be that we're just looking through photographs. We don't have the time to do the research, and so we're using photographs to make that assumption or basis of that. So it depends on who's available. Ideally, we'll encourage the park or the owner to hire a historian and prepare those reports in advance. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you mind if I get a little water?
So the other thing we're talking about, the collaboration with historians, historical architects, what about with the archaeologists?
Archaeologists are in there as well. More often than not, let's think Skagway here, because if there is a project where some foundation work needed to be done, for example, Old City Hall is an example of that. Before we do any work, the recommendation is to bring in an archaeologist and have them either monitor the work or do some shovel testing in advance. And if they start finding things, then they need to either slow the project down or stop it so they can do their investigations. Yeah. And a recent project that happened Ted Burkadal, our former team manager here, was working on some documents well after he retired. And he came to approach me about something in the mascot mm-hmm. building. And we were trying to piece together the parts and puzzles of something that he couldn't explain. And I think that's what's so fascinating about these professions is as they overlap, everybody's trying to piece together the components to figure out what happened. And so it's very interesting in that sense.
Do you remember the details of what Ted's...
It was something about underneath the floor, there was apparently another building that may have been in the place of the mascot before, and they wondered if they incorporated that foundation into the mascot or just kept moving on and just built right over it. And if we asked him, he'd...
No, I didn't know. Yeah. Did you solve the mystery for him?
Well...
Or did he solve the mystery?
No, together, we came up with our best guess.
Okay. You
know, history will only know.
That's right. It's always a little bit of a guessing game.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's what I can figure out, how with Skagway, the paint colors.
Yeah.
How do you know what color a building was painted when all of the photos are black and white?
Great question. Some of it's inference, I think, and you can tell the tonal differences in a black and white photograph. But ideally, you'll find a piece of wood that has paint on it still. And if you have a lot of paint on it, you can do two methods. One is what they call the bullseye method, where you sand it down. And down to bare wood in the middle, and you can see all the layers as it goes down towards the middle. And you want to get a clean sample of that. So you want to clean up the wood, a lot of dust and everything else has been on there. The other is to take a slice of wood, to cut it under a saw, and you look at it under a microscope, and you can actually see the layers of wood. And from there, with a well-lit environment, you can take paint samples and compare and contrast.
Really, with modern-day paint samples?
Modern-day paint samples. I mean, there are paint charts that relate to the historic period.
Okay.
But in the case of, you know, ordering paint today, we often just get it as close as we can. So, fascinating project or process is looking at it under a microscope. And is it conclusive? You know, you can go to a hardware these days and you say, match this paint, and they put it under some kind of a machine. I don't know. I mean, I think it's all in the eye of the beholder, but you're getting it awfully dang close.
Yeah.
And we were working on the Holy Assumption Church in Kenai, a National Historic Landmark, and we pulled off some of the wainscot down at the lower part of the wall and did this paint underneath a magnifying glass, or microscope, actually. And I counted 12 layers of paint.
Holy cow.
And what was most stunning, all sorts of blues, a green. At one point, there was a bright orange.
Whoa.
And then there was that, all the way back to the beginning was two layers of varnish over bare wood.
Yeah.
So you can make this very educated guess on what was there.
So what do you restore to, the two layers of varnish?
In that case, we went to a blue that was somewhere in the middle and used that. Because that was this theme of their church at the time and what they wanted. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I had a theory on the orange being something, I don't know, if during the gas efforts down there that somebody had some leftover orange paint. I have no idea where that came from.
I was thinking during World War II or something.
Yeah.
To mark it as a place, the landmark to not hit.
Not, yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, this is on the interior of the building. Too,
oh,
so,
I see.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, that didn't work.
But, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, you know, the paint studies, because I think they've had, I wasn't a part of that effort when they did it for Skagway. But I think they did a lot of research into the period. People, when they travel, they bring their styles and familiarity with them. So colors would have been a similar example of that. So, in style.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whatever the stores in Seattle were selling that they could bring up
on a boat. Right. That could be. Very well.
That would make sense.
Yeah.
But so the archaeology is only if you're doing a foundation. They don't
Generally speaking, archaeologists are going to work above ground or below ground, but in the building, it moves into our neck of the woods as opposed to an archaeologist. So archaeologists, let me give you another example here. The park is in the process of designing a new building for 4th Avenue, a dormitory that'll be right behind the Pantheon. And before any work is done there, they've had to have an archaeologist go in there and make sure it's clear. You know, I think a lot of the site was disturbed previously. And so they have studies of what was done there. Yeah. So other projects that I can think of around the state here, we've got a project in Nikolsky where they want to put a fence around a church because there's cows out there running around that keep damaging the church.
Mm-hmm.
And our recommendation is that they need to have somebody inspect that land before, because it could have been inhabited 10,000 years ago, and they come up with a massive site that they want to look at.
That's true. What about Dai? Have you done any work out there? Has there been any historic restoration out there?
Not too much. The only real surviving structure out there is the false front. And that was preserved and continues to stand, and the park is doing a moderate amount of maintenance on it. We've done been involved in some work with the Matthews Cabin, some recording of that work, but that building was pretty far gone by the time I got there. And then the McDermott Cabin, now known as the Patterson Cabin, mm-hmm. was donated to the park about 2008, I think, when the Tyre River was eroding the banks.
Right.
And so I was around when they moved that, and then we went in and we've prepared a historic structure report for that and HABS drawings and structural engineering drawings. And that's one of the projects that rumbles around in my head frequently because they're trying to move it, relocate it to somewhere in Dai to be a self-explored interpretive center type thing. So,
but if they moved it to Dai, it would no longer be on its original...
It's already been moved. It had to be saved from the river, so they moved it away from the river. It's been on blocks since 2008. Yeah, so... I in terms of the integrity of that, in this case, it's a great opportunity to move something and put it back into use as opposed to building something new.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got a lot of history and a lot of character.
Yeah.
So, but Dai's been I go out there periodically and they've opened up the trees on some of the roads where the historic street grid was, which I think is fascinating. And they've kept up. Things are as they are. It's just left to kind of do what it's going to do.
Well, then that gets into the landscape part of what you do, right?
Right.
Is that
right.
Sort of.
It does
overlap.
It does overlap. Yeah. Now, my it's kind of funny to. I often say that I masquerade as a landscape architect because no, I am not a landscape architect. I'm not a cultural landscape architect. I manage the program, so I'm helping manage the people who are running that program. But in the process, I've learned a lot more about what it takes to do these things. And it's very similar to the buildings where there's a history of use and the patterns of use associated with landscapes. And similar to an HSR, you're trying to prepare the documentation which explains and records all of that. And they go on a very wide scale, and they're GPSing all these different features in. If it was something as easy as like a farm that had fences and barns and things like that, some kind of a trenching system for water, so be it. But if you've got a really diverse and broad landscape, there's a lot of features that you've got to record and write about. So they always have their work cut out for them.
But yeah, so the landscape, does that include the built environment?
To a certain extent, if the landscape has features in it that affect the views, so purposely planted trees for a windrow, for example, or buildings, if you remove buildings, you're changing the view shed. Or if you build buildings in those things, you're changing the view shed. So you want their view is to preserve the integrity of that landscape without marring it. Maybe there's a select view that they was critical to that period of significance. If we go and put a building there, then you've just lost that view shed.
Right. And so would Dai kind of fall in that because it's no longer full of structures, it's now a landscape?
It is, yes. I mean, I think it's more of a cultural landscape than it is a built environment. You've got the false front. You've got a few other ruins of stuff, and those are more managed by the archaeologists than they are with the historic structure.
Right. But I was thinking, reciting where the streets would have been and the grid system and all that.
That's a cultural landscape idea, and a fascinating one, I think. I think it's... Dai is a remarkable place, it was a flash in the pan, and there's nothing left,
Well, and that's the thing, that's sort of what I was asking, is how do you decide, Mother Nature
took
it back, so how do you make the decision about keeping it with Mother Nature, taking it back, versus reinstating it to
Great
what
question.
It
and
was?
A lot of times, so the cultural landscape folks would go out there and write the report and make recommendations and say maybe that's cutting all the trees in the street grid is one recommendation, or doing a wholesale removal and clear cutting the whole place so that we can interpret it. But management ultimately has a decision. The superintendent has to make that decision, and I think probably for the right reasons they've said no. People like to come out here and walk through the woods, And yes, there was a community here, there was a town, but it's so far gone, there's nothing left. We're not going to recreate it, we're not going to reconstruct it. So we'll do some things, such as cutting these roads, but that's about it.
Well, and so, as you say, it was a short-lived community.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
I mean, look at the Chilkoot Trail, for example, which is, in my estimation, one of the most amazing trails that I've ever hiked because of the history, the significance. And I always like to say, when you get up to the summit and you cross into Canada, it's almost as if you're stepping across a line because the geography changes so much. You go from a rainforest environment to a high alpine, and it's just the coolest place ever. But in the management of that, you know, with as many people hiking it as they do, they've got to take certain measures to make sure that it's safe and accessible. And in that process, we've probably lost a certain amount of the tread, the historic tread.
Right. So. But they've also done a lot to leave the artifacts along the way.
If they can, right. And that, when you're climbing up the scales and you see something, it's just amazing. Or you go up to where on the summit where other artifacts have been left, and you just cannot believe that they're still there for over 100 years ago.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. Well, the cold preservation.
That's right. Yeah, frozen most of the year helps.
Yeah, that helps.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was thinking about other landscapes too, like, you know, the natural landscape. How do you, you know, it's always changing. You know, if you think about a river, it's always changing. So how do they decide what they're preserving?
Well, and I always wonder about trees. You know, if you have a, let's take an example in Skagway, the Moore House, the Moore Homestead. There are trees that were showing up in the photographs from, you know, very small ones that they planted. After those trees get big enough, do you cut them and put them back as a small tree again? You know, how do you do that? There were cottonwoods that grew there, and I remember they got removed in about 2005 or 6. And to a lot of the community members, they're like, what are you doing cutting these trees down? And, well, we're restoring that landscape to what it was during that period of significance. So again, you've got to find that bookend of what the dates are that you're looking at, and you're going to try and maintain it to that period. So on a river or a stream moving, that's a little more challenging. I mean, obviously nature's going to take its form, take its place, but you just work within the parameters that you have to make those decisions and try.
Well, it's interesting on the Moore House. I was thinking too, if they planted trees, you know, when they built that house, they, you know, 100 years later, they may be ready to die naturally, and then they're a hazard.
Yep.
So then the park would want to cut them down.
Remove them and then plant another one, and then in the same place, let them grow. Yep. So as an example, the Ice House, we call it the Ice House, the Frybrun cold storage building.
Mm-hmm.
It's up on blocks next to that. That was moved there in 2004, and there's a large tree, coniferous tree of some sort, where it's proposed to go now. And some people have said, just cut the thing down, let's move on. It's not even 50 years old, the tree. And we have historic photographs of when St. Mark's Cathedral or church was there in that area, and there was no tree. So historic, this tree's not historic. And the view of some is, no, we're not cutting this tree down, whether that building needs to go there or not, move the building. And other people are saying, just cut the tree down. Yeah. So it depends on, it's in the eye of the beholder.
And who makes those decisions, the park or the Historic District Commission? Or?
No, I think ultimately the superintendent will have to make those decisions with recommendations from the expert, the subject matter experts. You know.
How does the community get involved in some of these restoration project? I mean, obviously, like Virginia, it's her building, but the Park Service buildings, is there community involvement in that?
In some cases, if there's a major project, they have to go through the process, as any citizen does, to present it to the Historic District Commission. And so in the case of the relocation of the Frybrun, they would have to put in an application to do that and move it, and they'd probably have to cite that the tree would have to come out. In the case of that 4th Avenue dorm, just this week, I think, they're putting forward the proposal to the HDC to talk to them about this plan for a new building. And we're talking a new, large building in downtown Skagway, in the National Historic Landmark. And so one of the things that I was recommending, and I ended up drafting it myself, was to write a design intent, statement of intent, why we're doing what we're doing and how we're doing it and what we're drawing on from precedence to say this is why we've designed it this way. And a lot of that leans on Carl Gerke's research, as usual, where he shows us the historic photographs of what was there and we're using that historic building as a precedent to start the process.
Well, that's what I was wondering. If you're going to build that new building, can you build it to look like what used to be there?
We are, to a certain extent, yes. We're following main volume of the building, and there's a one-story addition off to the east, and so we're following that. And then we're adding on, because the program for the park is to have enough beds to sufficiently house people, and so we're putting another addition on the back, but we're using the typology and the precedents in Skagway that were done often in changing the style of the building or the window form or the siding to illustrate that it's an addition.
So, oh, I see.
Yeah, so we're using it, the precedent, as a good example of what was there, but then, and following it closely, but then drawing on other examples in the community.
So how would they distinguish? Would they put siding one, you know, vertical versus...
Correct, yes.
Horizontal?
In this case, we're doing horizontal siding along the main volume of the building, and then there's some vertical siding on this addition. Yeah. Kind of like on the Portland House, you know, the primary elevation has this beautiful fir siding,
oh,
and
yeah,
then you go around the corner, it's this vertical spruce board and batten, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So did you work on the Peniel Mission? That's before your...
Peniel Mission was before my time, but I've been all through that building from the maintenance perspectives. So that's a great example of an adaptive use for a building or rehabilitation, where they preserved the exterior and or restored the exterior and provided a contemporary use on the interior and divided it up and put in bunk rooms, mm-hmm, and a kitchen. And I think it's a very successful example of what the park has done down there.
Yeah. Well, the other buildings, what they've restored and then they lease them out for a local business, wouldn't that be a similar...
Similar thing, yep. So they again, there's the four treatments of preservation. Rehabilitation is one of them. And in my view, the people who crafted those standards had the foresight to recognize that if they were too stringent on their requirements, nobody would do this stuff. So the rehabilitation treatment has the flexibility to provide a contemporary use in a historic building. And by and large, it's restoring the exterior of the building to look as it does or did, and then making those allowances on the interior of the building. So putting in the elevator, putting in the kitchen, whatever it is needed in there.
So what are the other, you said there's four?
So preservation, restoration, rehabilitation, and then lastly is reconstruction. Reconstruction is the least used, and that's when you're full-on building a building. So in the case of, well, here, another great example in Skagway is the Pullen House.
Mm-hmm.
Former Superintendent Mike Trunell sought to rebuild that. It's privately owned, that property, but there's enough documentation through photographs and written descriptions that we could probably figure out how to rebuild it. And his hope was to work collaboratively with that owner to rebuild it and turn that into a MPS housing or perhaps a private housing option. And that would be considered reconstruction. It's not often used because it's not that original fabric, you know.
Right.
And the key there is to say to the viewer or to the whoever's in the building that this is a reconstruction. It's not the original building. So,
but the the Pullen House burned down, didn't it?
It did.
So there's nothing left.
Chimney is left. The
right.
Chimney is still there, yeah.
It's across from the Peniel Mission.
Correct.
Right? Isn't it right in there?
Yeah, it's right in there, tucked in.
So yeah, that would have to be a reconstruction since there's no building to restore.
Right. You'd be starting from square one,
yeah,
and you'd be using contemporary materials. But the photographs are such that you can determine size of things. And actually, mm-hmm, I think somebody did some field documentation, so we actually had floor plans of the building.
Yeah, you think, yeah, there'd be some physical evidence in the ground.
Exactly. Now, here's a wonderful segue to say, here's how archaeologists play a role in that, is because they have the ability to do an excavation. They can find the corners of that building just based on the soil disturbance.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty amazing.
That would be a cool project.
It would be cool.
From the photos I've seen, it looks like it was an amazing building.
Right. Oh, it was a big building, and it would be an interesting building to have.
And then you could put the Rapuzzi collection in there.
Yeah, you could. The Rapuzzi collection, now, yeah, that's that's an amazing story. So my kids are... I was in my son's fourth grade class a little while ago, and they're asking me what it is I do. And I said, well, what's your favorite building? And it just so happened earlier that day I was working on the Meyer building, mm-hmm, in the YMCA. So that's what I said. I said, well, there's this building called the YMCA in Skagway. And I said, this place was amazing. When we walked in there in 2006 for the first time, there was a single track trail and all this stuff thrown up to the walls at the natural angle of repose. I mean, there was just so much stuff
wow.
in there. And I said, there was a calendar on the wall. And I said this to this fourth grade class. I said, what year do you think it was? And they said, we don't know, you know, 1975? Or I said, 1938. So that gives you a frame of reference as to when it was last really occupied, mm-hmm. unless the guy just put it up on the wall. And then I said, as we continued through the building and you couldn't see much, and this is the Rapuzzi collection, basically, there were Model T tires still wrapped in paper, brand new, and Model T engines in a crate. And it's that kind of exploration that when you go into these buildings that have been locked up and tied up and nobody's been into them, and you see this stuff and you're thinking, my gosh, this is amazing. What an opportunity. You
yeah.
know? So, and then you get into the story of that whole building and you learn that the corner has that unique feature on it, on 5th and State, I think. And it was supposed to be a big tower that was going to be on this building. It was supposed to be a two-story building. So when you're up climbing around the attic and you find that these ceiling joists are 14 inches deep, and that's pretty overkill for normal ceiling, until you learn that they wanted to have another story going up on top of it.
So all those
clues,
were the floor joists.
That was the floor joists for the next story. And this weird thing that projects on the corner was going to be a tower on the corner of the building. So all these clues start coming back and making sense. You know?
So now would you guys build the tower?
No, in this case, we're just going to leave it, yeah.
Because it didn't...
It never got conceived, yeah. so we never... Yeah, we yeah. just leave it, but... and then this the Martinichin streetcar. I don't know if you've seen that, if you've had an opportunity to see that, but that's going to be stored inside this building.
Oh, I know what I've seen pictures of the old
yeah,
one, yeah.
Yeah, so just all these pieces come together, and every twist and every turn has an interesting...
But no, you see, that leads to a question. So Martinichin's old streetcar that he used for tourism will now be in this YMCA building, which is not where that car ever lived before.
No, no.
So that's kind of changing the use.
Well, it'll be in the neighboring building. It'll be in what was the Meyer building, a place called the Brown Shoe Store, mm-hmm. Brown Shoe Company. You're correct. It was never in there, but it's an opportunity to reuse that space and turn it into a museum space so that they can see, they can display this car.
Right.
It's in an environment that's not going to deteriorate the car. The good news on the YMCA is that that will be left as an open space. It was an open building, an open plan, no mm-hmm. walls or anything in the interior. Then it got repurposed again by the Meyer brothers, who turned it into a cold storage unit. They built in some walls and had refrigeration in there. The park made the decision to restore it back to the period, and it's now going to be used for presentations or trainings or whatever. At one point, we were talking about any number of things, putting a second story in there and having offices in there with an elevator. At one point, it was going to be a jail cell for law enforcement. It was going to be a library. It was going to be all these different things, and we finally came back to the conclusion that it's really should just be left open, and that's what it'll be used for, which is great.
Right.
Yeah. And during that process of stabilizing the floor, they found there was a floor over the original floor. There are still paint stripings from whatever game it was, like an indoor baseball game that they had on the floor. And so we have drawings of that to indicate what that looked like.
Is it nice wood flooring like those old basketball courts?
It was probably, yeah, it totally rotted because the thing sat into the ground, so it was just rotten. But it was probably Doug fir or maybe maple, yeah.
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 All these buildings we're talking about are, you know, old sort of Gold Rush era buildings. So are there more recent historic buildings, like from World War II era or other things that you get into?
In Skagway, there's the World War II commissary, which is next door to Soapy Smith's place. And we consult on some of these. I'm just trying to think. There's they call them the Seattle Knockdown Building, and that's the style that Carl turned me on to. And it's pretty characteristic of those that they were using in the Second World War because they were quick to put up. They were basically a kit building, and they could put them up quickly. And as you walk around Skagway, you can still see a number of them based on the dimensions, the plan, and the low-slope roof. So we see those periodically. But beyond World War II, there's not too much that I've consulted on past that, I don't think.
So are there efforts to restore... more recent buildings, or are they sticking with the Gold Rush era?
Well, for the park, their enabling legislation is really for their parameters, which I think is 1897 to like 1915, whatever it is. But the city's scope, I think, is broader. And so they actually own that World War II commissary. And we were asked to help with preparing some of the recommendations for that building, which some of that has left undone. But we've provided recommendations. We brought in a structural engineer to help out and gave them some direction.
Yeah, because the pictures I've seen of Skagway during the war, huge number of Quonset huts.
Oh, yeah.
And, I mean, it just totally changed the community.
Right, right. And they could have done far more demolition for a lot of these historic buildings. Unfortunately, they didn't.
Yeah, and those Quonset huts aren't there anymore. I mean,
no, there's only one that I'm aware of.
Yeah, so yeah. I don't know what happened to those.
Might have gotten picked up and moved, you know.
Yeah.
They often do.
Yeah, I mean, I guess people wanted the land to build their houses, I suppose.
Right, right.
Yeah. Because it was down sort of in the flats area. So you're going to Skagway and doing that work. You're coming from the regional office. How does that work, collaborating with the park itself? What's that relationship, and how does that work?
It works pretty well. I think, again, going back to when Steve Peterson was there, they didn't have any staff in their office who had this area of expertise. And Dave Snow, who was there at the beginning.
So he was the first...
I think he was the first historical architect to help with the buildings in that area, in that park. And actually, broader than that, a lot of the ones throughout the state, Dave Snow's fingerprints are on them. And then Steve was in there helping out and providing that assistance from this perspective. And then when I got involved, that was my role as well. And I don't think that there's any challenge in doing that. I think they welcome the input and they welcome the assistance. And now currently Annie Matsoff, who's the chief of resources there, has come up through the ranks of a historical architect as well, and so she's got that background, which lends assistance. So we're sort of double duty there.
Mm-hmm.
She handles a lot of that, and then I have the opportunity to help out where needed. So, and she's got her hands in a lot of other aspects of the work going on. So in the case of these drawings that are taking a very long time, it's something that our office is able to pull together. So
yeah, I mean, she's head of resources. She doesn't probably have a lot of time to do the historical architecture
investigation. Part. Yeah, she doesn't. I mean, she can go over and make some site visits periodically, and is informed enough to talk intelligently in meetings about compliance and other activities. But she doesn't have the time to be able
but
to.
Before her, has there been a person on staff in Skagway with a historical architecture background?
I don't think so.
It all came from regional
it
or
came
Denver.
From region, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, or Denver.
In the
right.
early days, it was probably Denver Service
Center. Is that Denver?
Center,
yeah.
I would guess.
Yes, because they're looking through all the old drawings, and we have a wealth of drawings in that period. Lots of DSC names in there, right?
Which I don't know why. Why would Denver Service Center have been doing it instead of the regional office out of Anchorage?
Well, I don't think that we had the staff and the capacity to take it on then at that time. I think that... If Dave was based out of, I believe, out of Denver as well.
Okay.
I don't think he was based in Anchorage or Skagway. If he was, it was for a short distance or time. And then they are set up to really be a full-scale architecture office down there.
They are.
Yeah.
They do it nationwide for all the part
they do
of the western region.
Well, it's changed. It's morphed a lot over the years. And I think currently they provide that service to line item construction primarily.
What does that mean?
Big projects, $1 million or over, or $500,000 and on up. And so their team in Denver Service Center is really helping out with that, and they can provide that full-scale assistance. But more and more now, we're contracting with A&E firms, architecture and engineering firms, than doing it in-house. One of the things that I think is important to recognize is the level of detail that we want to get into on, like, the YMCA Meyer. And I mentioned this earlier, is it's just cost prohibitive to have somebody come in from the private sector to do that, because we spend hours like on the phone looking at stuff and then drawing it up and then throwing it away and then drawing up something else, you know. So it takes a lot of time.
Well, that's what I was wondering, yeah, that having a staff with this historic architect program for the state seems more cost effective than contracting out.
It would, you know, if we could have a team in this office of three or four people like me and some people that are just drafters, it'd go a long way.
But yeah. You don't have that.
We don't have that. There's myself And then John Wachtel, another historical architect who's just 2 years in at this stage, 2019, and getting up to speed on what's going on. So it's, yeah. And everybody says, you know, what's historic? What's there to save up in Alaska? And I'm always surprised at how busy we are. We're flat out run all the time.
Yeah. That's why I asked. Besides, yeah. You know, Skagway and Kennicott, I can't really think of buildings. But once you start thinking about it, you know, an old trapping cabin.
Well, you know, just off the top of my head here, some of the park projects we have. I mean, Kennicott alone could hire an architect by itself, two of them probably. On the technical assistance side, as we work up from the south, we've got projects in Juneau, projects in Cake, Haines, Skagway, beyond the Klondike stuff we've talked about, stuff in Kenai out in Alaska, up in Fairbanks, Cordova. And there's just, the list keeps going on out in McCarthy, St. Paul, St. George. We've been to all these different places, and it's an amazing amount of work, and the history is just so terrific. So many wonderful buildings. Yeah, just keeps going.
That leads to my question of, like, what do you like about this work and this job?
Well, I don't know how to put it, but no 2 days are the same, right? Every day you come in and there's a new challenge that's confronting you, and it's often trying to keep up with the workload. But I think my favorite part of doing this work is getting out into these communities, getting to know the people, and getting to know the resources well enough to where a year and a half, 2 years from now, they can call me and ask me a question. And for some reason, when I look at these buildings, a lot of times it imprints in my mind, especially if I'm drawing them. And more likely than not, they can ask me a question that I can still try and piece together in my mind about what they're talking about. And if not, we're looking at photographs or drawings that we prepared from that site visit. And from there, we're trying to come up with a solution. So it's always solving challenges, which is fun, putting creative solutions to test and to get them together. And it's a lot of fun. But most importantly, just going out there and seeing these. And I love crawling through the buildings and seeing the stuff that you just don't normally see, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have something that's the most surprising that you've found in a building? Let's just say in Skagway?
I wasn't on site when they found that gun in Skagway, but I thought that was a pretty magnificent find. I remember crawling in the attic of Soapy's and seeing two or three, I forget what it was, the fires in the roof cavity. In Soapy's, when you have these aha moments and you're trying to figure out the pieces of the building, when I realized that the southernmost wing of Soapy's at that time was basically just held up with hardly anything. I mean, it was a a shoddily built building, but it has survived all this time. And actually, that goes back to the Portland building. That's kind of an anchor point for me. When we were looking at the Portland building and we determined there were no studs, no wall studs in the building, and the outside walls were basically two planks oriented vertically. And we brought a structural engineer down, and he kept saying, "Wow, that's interesting, that's interesting." And the second floor appeared to be held on with basically two nails on this ledger, this board that went across. There was nothing in that building that said it should still be standing 105 years later. And it still is, and now it's obviously far better and reinforced and all this, but I think that there's something to be said for buildings that have been around and had that many uses and still stand today and can explain through their clues and everything else of what it was and where it's been. You know, that's the joy.
It's amazing that, you say that building stood the test of time.
Yeah, earthquakes and everything, fires, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because now that you mentioned, I do remember Virginia telling me about how that one wall was just kind of laid there.
Well, let me this is off topic a little bit, but it's a funny story because Ford Theater in D.C., I'm on a committee that does some stuff related to fire suppression in old buildings, and we were trying to find a case study, and we started investigating Ford Theater to see if that might be a possibility. And they got to talking with the Park Service out there, and they learned that the only original piece of that building is a portion of the staircase in the back end of the building, maybe the banister only. And the person who relayed that story to me said, you know, that was like learning that Santa Claus is not real. the rug had just been pulled out. Because everybody walks in there thinking this is where Lincoln was shot, right? And the truth to what we do, and it's just so critical to walk in there and to be able to look at a building like Soapy's or like the Mascot or any of these buildings to know. For me, I want to know the answer. And so I went into the building. It was in Buffalo, New York, where Teddy Roosevelt was sworn in after McKinley was shot. And it's now a National Park Service site. And I got through, and they have this wonderful room where the swearing-in happened. And I'm looking around thinking, my gosh, this is where it's happened, right? And then the interpreter comes in and tells me, well, not so fast. At some point, this was a Chinese restaurant. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. You can just imagine the whole difference. He said that. He started pointing out the certain pieces of furniture that were original. And so you're staring and zooming in on those. Like, those were in this room, but this was a Chinese restaurant at one point. And so the Park Service did this wonderful job of restoring it back to that period. But think of all that happened. You know, this isn't where Teddy was. You know, yeah. I mean, yes, it was.
But isn't that the goal as a historic preservation person, is to restore it to a point where people can't tell?
It is, but at the same time, I'm of the business where I want to know right when I walk in there that this, because I was in there just steeped in the history for about 20 minutes thinking.
And you didn't notice. And you're a professional.
I didn't, how would you know until the guy told me it? But as soon as, I could just imagine like the chairs and tables and windows, who knows what had happened. But yeah, they did a wonderful job restoring it. But it's that truth. And that's where when you get into these buildings in Skagway, like the YMCA and Meyer, those are pretty doggone authentic. We've made some improvements and things, but boy, you can still walk in there and think like, wow, this is it.
You know? Well, but there you go. What was the truth?
Yeah.
Was it the Chinese restaurant or was it Teddy Roosevelt?
No, good point. And it was somebody's house before that and after that and all this stuff. So there's books out there. You know, if these walls can talk, they can tell you a whole lot. So. Right.
Well, I can tell from talking to you that this is clearly something you enjoy doing.
Yeah. I mean, there's days when you're tired of the nuts and bolts, but when you take the long view and you think that you're trying to save something for the long haul, that's where the enjoyment really comes from. Yeah.
Well, that was one of my questions, is what have been the challenges? I mean, we just talked about how great it is, but
there's all the challenges. Yeah. It's trying to get the work done to the quality, the level you want. Any number of projects I could be working on far longer than I am, and putting in much more detailed effort. And there's days when certain mistakes happen, you're like, well, geez, I knew that was going to happen, and I just didn't open my mouth, or I didn't tell them fast enough. An example of that is in Kenai, we were restoring the bell tower where the bells are on this church, and we had a grant to put in to restore it, and we're putting in basically a bathtub design, and I thought I had made it pretty clear in the drawings and notes that the floor is original. We need to carefully pick that up, and we're going to do everything to the floor, and then we're going to put those boards back down on there. And then I come to find out that they buried those boards down well in the assembly of the floor, never to be seen again. Uh-huh. And I just was so infuriated because I was like, no, that is the character. That is the stuff why we like to climb around these buildings. And when people go up there, they're going to see that original fabric that hundreds of people have been up there ringing the bells, standing on that floor.
And did they have a reason for it?
They didn't read the notes. They said, no, we thought you said to put it in the floor like that. And I said, no, look at this and that. And they ended up, they couldn't tear it up again.
Yeah, that's what to say, they couldn't tear it up again.
No, they just went and bought similar boards and put it down. But that's now encased in that floor, which is, yeah. So there's times like that you're just like, shoot, we didn't get the opportunity to get down there to talk with them in person to say, here's the objective. And that happens a lot. You're asking about how does it work from the regional office working in these remote communities. Well, you're not on site every day. You're dealing with photographs or talking on the phone, and the show must go on down there. So a lot of times it does, and the decisions are made that may not align with what you're hoping. And so, but, you know, life goes on.
What about funding?
Funding's always a problem. There's never enough money.
I was going to say, how do you fund? These are big, expensive projects. All those buildings in Skagway, how do you fund that?
Slowly over time. I mean, I have to keep going back to the same fund sources and asking for more money and keeping your eye on the objective. But the Park Service is in the business of restoring buildings, so they recognize the importance and the cost. And it's definitely cheap, or it's not as cheap as building new, so there's a lot of requirements.
So it can be cheaper sometimes to build new than to restore?
Yeah. Generally speaking, new construction is going to be a lot cheaper. I mean, I would say if you're looking at it on a square foot basis, building new in a place like Skagway might be $300 a square foot, and to restore something well could be, you know, $400 a square foot. So it's much different game. Yeah. And a lot of it's because of the unknowns or the requirements to go slow, saving materials, matching materials, and it just takes more effort.
Yeah, or somebody like Virginia, yeah. they saved every board and did every single board.
They're an exception to the rule. Those people were unbelievable.
Yeah.
Virginia and Howard, I don't know if they've received any awards, but maybe after this I'll send them a note and figure out how to do it.
Nominate them for something.
They really, really were something else.
Well, the other thing is doing this work within the structure of the Park Service, are you faced with challenges of federal government bureaucracies? Or does it help you or does it hinder you?
No, I think that we always gripe about the bureaucracy and the fact that it's just slowing us down. There's other mechanisms that you have to abide by that take your time, and whether it's supervising other people and getting involved in that, or even trying to secure funding for a project where you feel like you maybe want to be working on the actual nuts and bolts of the project. So, but every job has those challenges. I think that we do pretty well with what we have. There are times when we have missed out on projects because we haven't been able to travel to that. I mentioned that before, and it's because the process to get the funding or the travel approved. I missed a trip recently because I didn't have the paperwork approved in time, so I couldn't go out on this trip. You know, fair enough. Everybody's busy. I think that comes down to trying to do everything with what you've got, and you just have to focus on what you're working on for the time being.
And has that changed in the different federal administrations that you fall under?
It ebbs and flows, certainly. Funding becomes available one year and then not the next, maybe, administration. Sometimes there's policies that are more stringent. I think there's a marker in the GSA thing in Vegas years ago. That's why we started the whole travel ceiling discussion. When I first started, there was no travel ceiling. You could go pretty much anywhere you wanted for projects to do the work. You didn't have to do much justification. All these conferences now that you have all these requirements to fill out. So I think you have to just align with what you're doing, and you keep the bottom line is what you're trying to do is save these old buildings for me. So you work with what you've got.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll ask you the fourth grade question is, do you have a favorite building?
You know, that is a good question, and I didn't say this particular building when I was in that class. I often think that it's probably the building I started on. And in Alaska, it'd be the mill building at Kennecott. Yeah. It's just such a unique thing. And it's a real treat for me and an honor for me to be involved in the project that I feel like I've come full circle, starting in that building. And right now we're working on a huge $5 million project to help stabilize that building. And to be able to be the project manager on it is an absolute honor. From having started just recording the equipment in the building.
Yeah.
So.
Well, fun to have it go
full
circle. Yeah,
and go full circle and having worked on all sorts of different buildings. So it's been a real treat.
Yeah. What about in Skagway? A particular favorite building or project?
Yes. I mean, I think I love the administration building and the depot. I think those are two very, very beautiful buildings and just the history of them. I am fond of the YMCA and the Meyer just from my involvement from start to almost finish, I guess, at this stage. On Broadway, I could say a lot of different buildings. You know, the Verbuiz's store is a cute little building. The A&B Hall, even though it's not Park Service. The proportions and the design and the quality of construction, a lot of those buildings are just awesome. Old City Hall, or the City Hall building, the one that's currently City Hall, is a beautiful building. And Old City Hall for its uniqueness. Yeah, the Portland building for its uniqueness. And just so, yeah, I don't know that I have any one favorite. I have different experiences and appreciations for all of them. Yeah.
Do you have a project that you're most proud of? It sort of fits in the favorite building, but there might be different.
Well, in Skagway, I mean, the Portland building, I'm very proud of the work that was done there because I think we really hit a home run on that, and it's in large part attributed to Howard and Virginia. You know, they weren't believers right away, but once they got that understanding of what they were doing, they took off to the races.
So how did they get connected with you or to become believers?
I think that I remember actually a call, and this is when I just started. I mean, I was months into the job, and I think people in that town would call up Carl Gerke or Teresa Tebow and say, "Hey, I need help. What can you do?" And they knew this new guy was in the building up here, and they said, "Well," they'd call Steve, and Steve would say, "Hey, go talk to him." And I remember working with them very, very early in my career in the Park Service, and having the opportunity to go down there a couple times and working with them and talking to them, and it was repeated. It was just going back and being enthusiastic and having fun with it. And right. I think they
was well, yeah. It sounds like yeah that they sought out help.
Oh, they did
in Skagway from the Park Service there.
Yeah. And a lot of our inquiries come from Carl. He'll email me and say, "Expect a call from so and so," or when Teresa was there, or when Annie's there, and then we get to know people, and then we'll set up meetings, and we're down there. Somebody might say, "Well, he's going to be in town on this day," and we'll set up a meeting and go talk and walk through the buildings. You know, that happened with the Presbyterian Church. It happened with Ada Hoskins' house. I'm trying to think of other buildings, but
it does sound like also Skagway is a community that is interested in historic preservation, maybe so than other places.
I think by and large, people they understand why it's as successful as it is. You know, I don't know that people would be going there in the numbers that they are if it wasn't the unique town that it is.
Yeah,
and I think a lot of that is attributed to the Park Service's investment and doing it correctly at the beginning. When I look at photos from the 1970s of that place, and there was nothing done, they started doing it right, and everybody followed suit. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it was fun to look at Spoody's historical preservation data report from 1983.
I know.
And he has those sort of panorama
of gray buildings
of these buildings on this block and that block, and it's really amazing.
The barely difference. Standing, some of them.
Yeah.
You know? Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, it's fascinating. You know, the next question would be worth asking is what's going to happen in the future down there? You know, with a million visitors a year and the numbers going up and bigger cruise ships, how do you accommodate that? And when have we loved a park to death, you know? And that's a tough question.
Do you have an answer?
I do not. I do not.
And how do you protect those buildings from all those
cyclic maintenance?
Footsteps.
Yeah, cyclic maintenance. And I get off to those guys in maintenance a lot for this, because I think we need to keep our eye on the maintenance of these buildings, because if you don't do it, if you let little problems persist, they'll have long-lasting effects, negative effects.
And so what's their next project, the ice house?
That is one coming up, yep. The ice house is a big one, and finishing off that Meyer and YMCA is a big one. Building this 4th Avenue dorm, and then working on the Patterson Cabin out in Dyea is another one that's coming up. But I think in terms of my workload, that ice house is going to be another one that's coming up.
Looks like a very rickety structure.
Well,
I can't imagine moving it.
Let me. This is an interesting story, because I don't know how much time we have left, but the history of that building, there was an aha moment, and we had a team of interns working with us doing the Habs drawings in 2008. And somebody was just poking around in Carl's collection of photographs, and they found a building that led us to believe that it was a certain building down on the waterfront. And then they somehow tied it back to this Fry Brune business. And well, I happened to be down in Seattle one time, and there's this place called the Fry Museum. And it's free and open to the public, an art museum. And the Fry of Fry Brune, that is their museum, because they made all this money in the meat industry. They had no heirs. And they had this collection of money, and they loved art, apparently. So I went into the Fry Museum one day, what year it was. And I said, "Do you mind if I talk to the archivist here?" And I told her who I was and what I was doing. And she said, "Well, come with me. Let's go down to the basement. I've got these two boxes on the history of the Fries," or whatever it was. And within 2 minutes, we had found a photograph of the building that we had not seen, that today is being used as a very critical photograph, showing an addition to the building that we didn't know about, showing it up in the air so that it could be offloaded with meat and everything else. And that kind of excitement of making that connection, or happening to be, you know, going able, being able to go into the Fry Museum, into the archive, going down to the bowels of that building and seeing that, and then having that photograph to help guide the direction of the project, is just, I mean, that's the excitement.
Yeah. Well, I've changed it to a little different note, which is, any failures or things you wish had happened differently?
In Skagway?
Sure.
Sure. Yes, I mean, I think there are all sorts of projects where we didn't get it to the level we wanted to, and some things that are left undone. I mean, we started some of these projects in 2008, and they're still going because we get pulled in many different directions. So we don't necessarily have complete packages for two of those buildings from the Rapuzzi collection. That would be the Rapuzzi House and the World War II commissary. We were supposed to come up with a preservation easement for that commissary building, and I think the Rapuzzi House. Now, those are in the hands of the city, and I'm not sure they know what they want to do with them. But we should have all that documentation done. It's fallen short, so that's something that I feel like. And the same with, you know, the continuing four-year battle on these drawings for the YMCA Meyer. It shouldn't take that long, truthfully. So it's frustrating to see something that takes that long, and hopefully it won't happen with the Fry Brune or the Patterson and these other projects, but you never know. So in terms of failures and, like, full-on problem buildings, I was involved with the elevator in the Pantheon, and that, to my best of my knowledge, is it works intermittently. And I don't know, and, you know, that building was designed with the cavity ready for an elevator. And so when I got the project, I was the one who was hired to put the elevator in. The elevator was in, it worked for a while, and then it stopped working. And so that, the little things like that that don't leave you, you know, you remember them. But I haven't had anything that I think went wrong in terms of, like, a collapse or, you know, major failure. But
any building, whether Skagway or elsewhere, that sort of the building that got away that you wished could have been restored?
Well, I guess I still have my hopes out for the mill building in Kennecott.
It's still standing.
There's no roof on the top, and
that
has been taken out of our project. So, in fact, over my lunch today, I was talking to those guys saying, well, that's the next big step, is trying to figure out how to get a roof on that building. But, yes, there are some buildings that I feel like we've missed the mark or haven't gotten there yet. And I'd have to think. I mean, I think there are some that I wish I was more involved in. Nothing comes to mind now, but there are some that I wish we could put more energy into. So, yeah, good question. I'll have to think about that.
You know, I think we had this happen in Fairbanks. There was a fire at an old building.
Yeah.
And then it got torn down. I've seen one of those things that it's like, oh, we just...
Well, that's true. And I think of, in Fairbanks, like the... what was it that just collapsed under the snow load a couple of winters ago?
Yeah, that's the one I was thinking of.
I'm trying to think if we have lost anything to fire. Not necessarily in the Park Service, up at Hatcher's Pass, that one old roadhouse. Mm. That roadhouse out in Copper Center was lost to fire.
Yeah.
That was a shame. But we didn't have any involvement.
But there was nothing that you've been involved with that maybe there was negotiations to work
nothing
on.
Nothing, knock on wood.
And then it went away.
No, I think we've missed. I'm just mentally here scanning a variety of things to see if anything's collapsed from not being able to get to it in time.
And, yeah.
No, I don't think so.
Well, if that's the case, you're lucky.
So far, yeah. Knock on wood. Yeah.
Well, I appreciate your time today.
It's been a pleasure, fun.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you wanted to talk about that maybe I haven't asked about that comes to mind?
No, I could see doing this again and just focusing at kind of a free random about my time in Skagway, because I think it's important to talk about various projects, and we touched on a number of them, but if I sat down and really put...
Do you have other ones that I haven't asked about?
Well, no, I'm just trying to think. I'd have to go through my records and just see if there's stuff in there that I wanted to talk in more detail about, you know. And I think if this is going to be written down and put into an archive, talk about certain projects and people that were involved, it'd be helpful to do that.
Yeah, so. Do you remember particular people involved?
Yeah,
you mentioned Don Corwin.
Well, Don Corwin, sure. I mean, the chiefs of maintenance who had gone through there, I think John Warder was the first one when I came in, and then several others. Johnny Powell was there, and another guy who's in Denali now, but I should know all these people's names. See, that's why I was hoping to do my research.
Dave, what's his name? Denali.
Dave Schurkauer. He was in the head of Natural down there.
Okay.
I mean, there's been a lot of different personalities. Bruce Noble, the superintendent, Jim something or other, and Mike. Mike had a lot of ideas. He was an idea guy, and so he was pushing a lot of things around. And he came up with the whole Pullen idea, Pullen mm-hmm. House. Teresa Thibault was also a very enthusiastic and capable person who was pushing things forward. A lot of personalities and it's just a rich history.
Yeah. You know? But so like the superintendents, you worked. Everybody was supportive of restoring all these buildings.
Yes, I think they all knew and they recognized that's really the one of the core things of the park is those buildings. And so some gave them a little more emphasis than others in terms of the long-term maintenance and getting us involved. And some would reach out to us more if they felt more comfortable on certain levels, or they would take us under advisement, you know, and then move on, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think it's important for those superintendents to know what their enabling legislation is and what they've got. They're sitting on quite a unique history.
Well, and I was thinking the maintenance crew, you know, that they're assigned to work on maintenance versus being pulled in to do something else. I don't know.
Yes.
Did that happen that, you know, something was supposed to be maintained and it wasn't because they were pulled in a different direction?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of those things where it's the fire of the day, you know, what do you have to chase today as opposed to doing what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And in certain circumstances, we might have pointed things out on these annual inspection reports that didn't get followed up on, and now we're having to do a whole lot more work than we needed to because we didn't pay attention to it fast enough. But it happens everywhere, and it's just a fact of everybody's got a lot going on and not enough time to do it all.
What about the actual construction crews, the carpenters and mechanics and whatever else is they're doing in those buildings?
You mean,
what are they like to work with? Or some particular people who were standouts?
Yeah, they're all good people to work with and enthusiastic, and I think a lot of them are really passionate about what they do. Some people see it as its job, and that's what it is, and others are really digging into the research and want to know the why. And that's what we like, actually, is the people who come and ask, well, I understand how to pound a board in, but why am I doing it this way? You know, and that's where you have to bring in that education component. And we've done a few trainings down there through a program called the Vanishing Treasures Program to help educate these people on the preservation of the why of doing it this way as opposed to mm-hmm. just doing it. There's a real difference between carpenters who do just, you know, contemporary build whatever, and then the what I would call a craftsman, people who take the time and are willing to do that. There's a big difference there. So anybody can pound in a board, but can you do it in the manner that's really the way that we want them to do it? So.
Well, and that's kind of what I was wondering is, are the people doing that carpentry those skilled craftsmen?
Some of them are definitely getting into it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Some people have the background as a carpenter, but now they're being steeped in this old school business and enjoying it.
Yeah,
and,
so it's a bit of a specialty.
Yes. It's a niche, yeah.
That they go and study up on or get special training, probably on-the-job training.
I would say it's on-the-job, and a lot of these people have done it where they've worked through, you know, under the tutelage of somebody else, and then they've branched out on their own and said, okay, I understand what they're doing now, and then build from there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because it's a slow and painstaking.
Yeah, well, like Don Korn, I think he was sort of self-taught.
Yeah. And then Don was on that crew down there building doors and windows and all sorts of stuff for many years. And now he's a mentor to many of the people down there. And beyond, you know, he's right now he's up in Fairbanks working up there. So, yeah. Yeah. he's got a lot. Yeah, well, no, I at some point, if we were to do it again, I'd have to come back with some other thoughts. But,
well, I might be back.
Okay.
Thanks, Grant.
Yeah.